My name is Johnny Blakely, and I'm what's left of an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. Mike was talking about his legs. I know how you feel. A girl in a bar one night told me I ought to sue my legs for non-support. I sat down at a table full of girls one night, was really going to impress them. About 10 minutes later, one of them said, "Some people over at that other table want you." And I looked over there, and there was nobody there. And I said, "Who?" And she said, "Everybody at this table." So, anyway, you're going to have to sit through the same crap you heard 14 years ago. So this has been a journey. My program has been a journey. First, I want to thank Mike for having the poor taste to invite me to speak. And I enjoy doing this. I don't know if it comes through or not. I hope it does. But it's an honor and a privilege to speak to a bunch of people who concentrate and focus on staying sober one day at a time, just like I do. And people who realize that we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And with these cooler temperatures, I have recovered from a hopelessly steaming condition of mind and body. And it does feel better out there, and I'm glad it cooled off. Maybe it won't be so hot in here tonight. Let's see, it was a cool spring day. In Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, June 16th, 1946. And to save you getting your calculators out, I'm 65. I had my first out-of-body experience. And the next thing I knew, this guy that outweighed me by a good 160 pounds was holding me up by the heels, slapping the hell out of me. Then they cut my supply tube and tied that in a knot, and I thought, what is happening here? The hell is going on? Separation anxiety may have set in then, I think. All of a sudden, I became dependent on everybody else for everything I needed. And I learned quick how to get what I wanted. I talk a lot out of the big book because it has so many answers. I have so many things that I study outside the program that are fantastic and help me focus on my program. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the center of my sobriety, and God is the center of my program. So standing on that footing, it's hard to pull me in one direction or the other. I can feel the pull, and I stop, and I get back to center, and I don't have to react in ways that are going to be detrimental to my sobriety or to somebody else's. When Bill and Bob were talking to the man on the bed, on page 42 in the big book, says, then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That was not easy, but the moment I made my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. The next sentence in here is, for me, the most important sentence in the big book, and everybody has a different one, but this one is for me. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I had problems coming into this program. I had drank up an 18-year marriage, during which I was reasonably faithful. Meet a girl in the bar and say, I'm separated. Well, there were 350 miles separating us, so she was in Birmingham, I was in Florida. So I figured that really wasn't that big a lie. It was a really sordid way to live, and it was not a productive way to live at all. And I didn't realize it, but every time I did things like that, and every time I got drunk when I was supposed to stay sober, and every time I showed up for work with a hangover that would kill a mule, I took a little piece of me out. And I finally wound up where I had pushed everything and everybody out of my life that could affect my drinking, until I was finally left alone with the one person I never wanted to be alone with to begin with, and that was me. I could not stand the thought of being alone with myself. Where did everybody go? I need y'all now. I didn't really mean to push you that far. Come back. I need you. And people weren't coming back. I had cried all the tears up I could generate. It just wouldn't come. I was walking home from a beer joint one night, and I was raised in a denomination called the Church of Christ, which is one reason I love coming here. I'd get a real spiritual connection in this building. And there was a Church of Christ on the way home, where, and the state had asked me to ride on the right side of the truck for a while, and I didn't have anybody to drive me home. Yeah, I was doing graduate work at a DUI school. And I did not go to a treatment center. I went to a mistreatment center. It was the Douglas County Jail. But I went back in the good old days when they fed them three times a day. But it was raining, and I was wet, and I was miserable, and I was drunk, but I wasn't as drunk as I wanted to be, and I couldn't pass out. And I sat down up under the eave of that church, and I was sitting there trying to cry, and nothing would come. There was just no emotion left in me. It was gone. I was just completely hollow. I had become a shell of a human being. I had become a person completely wrapped up in himself. And the Japanese say that a person wrapped up in himself makes a very small package. Well, I had become a package you could send anywhere on the planet for first-class postage. It would not have been difficult. Probably a postcard. What did I do after that? Well, the next night I went and got drunk again. And it probably worked that night. So the routine kept going and the routine kept going. I started drinking when I was about five. And my parents, I was adopted and brought here from Canada. And I was raised by two of the best people that ever lived. Never saw either one of them remotely drunk. But they'd drink a six-pack of beer, six-pack of Budweiser every night when they went to bed, three apiece. Never saw them drink more or less. Daddy put salt on the top of his can, and Mother poured salt in her glass. She drank hers out of glass. She was a lady. And in fact, she was a great woman. She really was. School teacher. I loved her. Still miss her. But they would give me a few sips of their beer when they found out that it would put me to sleep. And I was a pain in the behind when I was a kid. I was a monster. I was high speed and spring loaded. It's okay. Parents are usually glad when their kid likes the taste of the toothpaste that they have selected for the household. And I liked it. But the only thing was, I didn't want that 1 inch you put on your toothbrush. I wanted the whole tube. At 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I would eat a whole tube of Colgate toothpaste just because I liked it. It was, perhaps an early indicator. I probably need to do more research on that, but I think that's a pretty accurate observation. My mother would give me a quarter every morning to eat lunch at school, and that's what the lunch at school cost, for 25 cents. Well, they had ice cream sandwiches there that were 5 cents apiece. How many is that? 5 ice cream sandwiches. That's what I ate every day at lunch. And I'd be in the classroom running around the walls, and nobody knew why. But that's the way it was. My whole life was like that. The only thing I was ever addicted to was more. By the time I got into high school, by the time I got 15 years old, I was drinking alcoholically. And by that, I mean I was drinking to get drunk. I was not drinking to impress the girls. I was not drinking to impress anybody else. Excuse me. I was drinking because I didn't feel good enough until I had some alcohol in me. Then I blended in with everybody. I was as big as the tight end on the football field. I was as good looking as the best looking guy in class. I was as smart as the president of the Honor Society. I was everything I needed to be once I got some alcohol in me. I heard a guy say at Douglasville one time that every time he drank, the promises came true. If it was only for a couple of hours. And I've heard Clancy say that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does for us exactly what alcohol did. It just takes longer to do it, and it does it on a much more permanent basis. So I got to thinking about that, and by God, he was right. It surprised me. Got to 15, 17 years old, 16, 17 years old. I played the clarinet in the Birmingham Youth Symphony for 2 years, and then I discovered girls. Now, next to booze, girls was the biggest discovery I'd ever made. I figured if God did anything better than that, he kept it to himself. As long as I could get all the booze I needed and all the girls I wanted, I'd be fine. I made it through high school, joined the Navy, and went off. I was going to see the world through a porthole. I was stationed in Key West for 7 months and have crawled all up and down Duval Street numerous times. Used to drink at, the Havana Madrid was at the end of Duval Street, and it's where the shrimpers drank, and it was off limits to military personnel, so we put our civvies on and go in there. Big mistake. Those guys like to fight, and there weren't a whole lot of women in there to begin with, so if they can't do that, they want to fight. Well, anyway, made it out of Key West, went through 17 months on a minesweeper bobbing up and down the Atlantic Ocean. And a pretty uneventful military career. I did my job. I was okay. Had some accommodation letters. Came back to Birmingham. Bought a brand new 1968 396 Chevelle Supersport. God would love to have had this car. And you talk about looking good in something. Soon I got a couple of beers in me, I look good in that car. And wherever you were going to see me. I was going to see to it. And I dragged and drag raced and fought, and I played semi-pro football for 5 years when I got out of the Navy, and I discovered the wonderful world of speed. On our sidelines at our games, we would have a bag of speed, and we'd have a bag of pot, and we'd have a cooler full of beer. So when you weren't on the field, you could go to the concession stand. That's what we did. And we did. And I have never in my life felt anything like the feeling you get when you hit somebody on a football field really hard, and you've done a black RJS about 4 hours before that. It will send your toenails get goosebumps. It was the most amazing feeling. I loved it. I run it to me. Hit me. Run it to me. But I had some people that I've done a four-step on and have forgiven that introduced me to my ex-wife. And you'll think about that on the way home, just laugh. They introduced me to the girl that was going to become my wife. We went together 3 months, got married, and we were really happy, and then we cared a lot about each other. We really loved each other. There was nothing wrong with her. She was a good woman. She liked to drink and party, too, but she told me, she said, look, it's me or the drugs, one of the two. So I flushed all the drugs down the toilet and never looked back. That's how I know in my heart that there's a difference between a pure alcoholic and a pure addict. I did a 5-gallon bucket full of cocaine over that 4 or 5 years, and have smoked a dump truck full of pot. In turn, I've done enough acid to have frequent flyer miles. That may be what's wrong with me now. I don't know. All these people keep saying they get flashbacks, and I don't. I got a resentment about it. I have a freebie every once in a while. But anyway, she said, it's them or me. So I did that. Put them away. It's no big deal. And she said, if you want to drink, that's fine. But you're not going to do all that other stuff. And I said, yes, dear. So I did. And putted along in marriage. Became reasonably successful, I guess. I became a crane operator. And cranes had always fascinated me, and I played with them when I was a kid, the little Tonka cranes and all the little toy cranes and all that, and I loved them. Well, I finally got in a job where I could run one. They would actually let me get in the seat and pick the headache ball up and down and swing that thing around, and I'd died and gone to heaven. So for the next 35 years, I picked that headache ball up and down, and I swung that thing around. I was hanging iron over off Steve Reynolds Boulevard one day. And I picked a piece of iron up, picked a beam up off the ground, weighed about 2,500 pounds. And I was carrying it up to two connectors who were about 150 feet up somewhere in that neighborhood. And on the way, the one thing a crane operator, when you're hanging iron, has to remember is where you got that last piece of iron. Because that, unless somebody tells you different, that's where you're going back to. Well, it dawned on me about halfway up there that I had no earthly idea where I picked that piece of iron up out of that iron pile. And I really didn't even know which way it went or which way the numbers on the steel went. The numbers run a certain way when you're putting a steel building up. And I didn't understand. So I stopped. I just stopped the crane and left the beam hanging up there. Got out on the catwalk, and the pusher walked over and said, is anything wrong? I said, nah. I just had kind of a funny feeling for a minute. I'll be okay. He said, do you want to go home? I said, no. I'll be fine. I said, just give me a minute, and I'll get back in the seat. So I got back in the seat and hung the beam, and the rest of the day was uneventful, but that scared me. That's the first time in my life, in my career, and at that time it had been about 30 years that I'd been running a crane. That was the first time in my career that alcohol had actually affected my performance and had gotten it to the point to where I realized something's wrong. Something ain't right. Well, I got a divorce in 1990, and came to Douglasville, Georgia. I came over here to work on the dome, bring Georgia Dome out of the ground. And going through a divorce, and somebody said, have you ever stopped over at that Longhorn in Douglasville, Georgia? I said, no. And they said, well, you ought to check that place out. I went in there. I fell in love about 15 times first afternoon. And I thought, wait till these Georgia women get a load of me. Well, apparently they never got the memo. There were no lines outside my motel room door, so apparently the word did not get out. But anyway, I kept falling in love, and I spent money like I had it. If I saw a girl in there that looked like she needed a drink, I bought her one. I was making a ton of money at the dome. We were working anywhere from 60 to 80 hours a week up there, and anything over 40 hours was time and a half. And I had enough money to burn a wet mule. I went through the Crystal one night to get something to eat on the way home, and I woke up at the drive-thru window with a cop beating on the window. And he said, can you drive that vehicle? I said, well, how the hell do you think I got it? Not the answer he wanted. He said, how about pulling it right over there by that curb? I said, what about my food? He said, we'll feed you. And they did. They were as good as their word. I just had a gourmet breakfast the next morning, I remember. I remember almost being able to keep it down. That was my first encounter with a DUI in the state of Georgia. There would be three more after that. To tell you how bright I was when I drank, I was driving around in Cobb County, of all places on the planet, in Cobb County, with an expired tag taped to the back window of my truck with no license and no insurance, going to work. Well, the cop followed me right on into the yard where my crane was, and I parked by the crane, got out. We had a little chat, and then he and I left together. I spent the next 3 days in the Cobb County spa. Oddly enough, I had done the tower cranes on that new addition to the Cobb County Jail, and there I was sitting in it. I helped build a jail to put myself in. Did any of this register with me? No. Anyway, it finally reached the point where I was waking up in the woods behind a beer joint. Sometimes I'd wake up out there with it raining. I'd get up and walk home, change clothes, go to work. That afternoon, start drinking again. That night, do the same thing. I may make it home that night, may not. I told somebody at the beginner's meeting, this is the most humiliating thing I've ever had happen to me. I woke up next to a pretty good-looking girl one morning. She looked over at me, and she said, oh, no. Now, AA should hire this woman as an ego deflator. That was humiliating and embarrassing. But oddly enough, I understood what she meant. And I used to tell people all the time, I wouldn't date a woman that'd go out with me. I got better standards than that. Anyway, I finally got to the point to where, like I said, I was doing graduate work in a DUI school. And that meant I was a second run through there. And the lady said, very few alcoholics will ever stop drinking until they have lost everything. And I thought, you are so full of crap. Now, what I owned at that point was my house had burned in Birmingham. There was no homeowner's insurance on it. I lost everything I owned in that fire and the move over here. So all I had was the clothes that I had when I came over here to work for a week and had a little money in my pocket. And I was doing okay, I thought. Had a couple of new ball caps. And that's really all I needed. But I was thinking, you know, you are so full of crap. I hadn't lost everything. I had lost everything. And then all of a sudden it started dawning on me, yes, you have lost everything. It's gone. All the stuff your mom and daddy left you, all the stuff you accumulated while you were married that she didn't take with her when she left, it's gone. And I got thinking, this is not good. So I decided something had to be done. And I heard somebody talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a guy at the DUI school talking about the Douglasville group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said that this thing was behind the drugstore in downtown Douglasville. Well, if I could have found him the next time I tried to find it, I'd have given him a whipping. Because it wasn't behind that drugstore. I hunted for that thing. I walked all over downtown Douglasville looking for an AA meeting at a drugstore. There was a drugstore in Douglasville. And there wasn't one. So I went and got drunk. Well, the next morning I woke up and I had this feeling like, this cannot happen again. This cannot happen. I cannot do this again. I'd rather be dead than have to do this again. So that evening I went back to downtown Douglasville. And this is one of those things where it was God working in my life and I didn't realize it. I went up there on the square in downtown Douglasville, and there was this sweet little lady, in her 70s, looked like, walking across the square. And I walked over, and I said, ma'am, would you happen to know where there might be an AA meeting in this area? She looked at me and winked. She said, follow me. So that was my angel. She didn't even stay in the program long after that. I don't know if she's drinking or not, but she quit going to meetings not too long after that. She stayed there long enough to get me to that meeting. That was what was important. I walked up 22 steps to my first meeting. There was a lone light bulb hanging at the top of those stairs. That light bulb was so prophetic to me because I felt like I'm walking toward a solution. I'm going somewhere where I can get some help. And I went into that meeting, and they said, do you want to quit drinking? I said, yes, I do. And they said, well, sit down and listen. Just sit down and listen. Keep coming to meetings. You'll hear what you need to hear. And the people here will help you all they can help you. And this is a really good-looking woman telling me this. I thought, things are looking up. Then later that night, she hugged me. Now, I hadn't had a woman hug me voluntarily in a long time. And, yeah, usually that cost extra. To show you how scared I was, she was married and had this big diamond ring on, big diamond ring set on, and I was holding her left hand while we were saying the Lord's Prayer, and she kept saying, let go, let go, and I thought it was one of the signs on the wall in there, let go, and I said, what's the matter? She said, you're cutting my finger off, let go, and I was squeezing her hand so hard that it was cutting into her skin on her finger, and she said, no, it's happened before, don't worry about it, but, I didn't realize how scared I was till I got there and finally just broke down and said, you know, I either go here or I go nowhere. This is it. And then I found out that a spiritual solution would solve all my problems. I was on probation in two different counties with three different probation officers, none of whom knew each other. Had to take a day off work to see each one of them every month. My employer was just about up to here. He had had just about enough. He told me, he said, you got too much baggage. He said, you need to do something about your drinking or you're gone. He said, if you want to quit drinking, you can have a job with me the rest of your life. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to work Monday. So that was, you know, even I could understand that. So I did, and I stopped. And the journey I set out on the night I stopped has surpassed anything I could ever possibly have hoped for. One of the great, great, great liberating aspects of this program is I spent so much of my life caring what other people thought about me and trying to live in a way where I could at least convince them that I was the kind of guy they wanted me to be. Now, when I wasn't around them, I was not. But when I was around them, I would be the kind of guy they wanted me to be. I spent so much time giving people power over me. There is one who has all power. That means I've got no power, but neither did they. And I gave them all that power, and they never had it to begin with. It was all an illusion. So now nobody has any power over me. I don't fear anything. I really don't. I'm really not scared of anything. People talk about being scared of jumping out in front of a bus. Well, that's an awareness. I am aware of the fact that if I step in front of a moving bus, I'm going to lose. That was another thing. Remember that on 37 in here where it talks about the jaywalker? Well, one of my pet peeves used to be people that gave themselves nicknames. I thought that was the most arrogant thing a human being could do. Well, I got an AA, and I immediately started calling myself Jaywalking Johnny. And for some reason, it stuck for a long time, and I like to never got rid of it because I finally realized what I had done, and I didn't want to do that. I did not want to be called Jaywalker, and that's what most of the people were calling me. But that's how easily my ego will drift me back into illusion. And it's always this. We talk about the disease out there doing push-ups in the parking lot. So is my ego. My ego is that part of my brain that wants me to think I'm separate and apart from God, separate and apart from y'all, separate and apart from everything. There is the universe and Johnny. Now, to be fair to everybody who wants to be the center of the universe, if the universe is indeed infinite, infinity has no center, and you can be the center of the universe if you like. It's entirely up to you. It won't mean anything, but you can be the center. And I'll even acknowledge that you are. My ego had led me down so many paths, so many paths. I just remember when I was little, I was never big enough, strong enough, tough enough, cute enough, smart enough, able enough, educated enough, athletic enough. I was never anything enough until I got a couple of drinks in me. And then, like I said a while ago, then I was probably a little better than you and would tell you so. Alcohol solved all my problems at that point. Sandy B said when he got to program with Alcoholics Anonymous, he realized alcohol was not his problem. His problem was that he considered alcohol as the solution to all his problems. And that's where the problem came from. I wrote a bunch of stuff down. I hadn't talked about any of it. I was living an in-here versus out-there mentality. When I'm living in ego, that's exactly what I am doing. I'm living an in-here versus out-there. It's up to me to get what I want to be happy and to claim my stuff and to keep you from getting my stuff and to keep anybody else from keeping me from getting my stuff. It's me against the universe. Now, I'm no match for anybody in this room, probably. There's still a lot of girls that can whip me. And being able to whip me is, no high water mark in your life, believe me. I sometimes get to the point to where I wonder, why did I have to be something different? What was wrong with me? Why was I never enough? And part of it was because I cared so much about what other people thought about me. I thought without their approval, I was going to be miserable. Trying to get their approval made me miserable. I started life out on drugs. I was drugged to church, drugged to school, drugged to weddings, drugged to family reunions. I thought we had family reunions to keep score, see who had done the best. This was all ego-based thinking. It was this drug called approval. When I did something that the big ones liked, I would do it till I bled or until they stopped laughing. And it was usually the latter. They would stop laughing, and my dad would say, "That's enough. Shut up. Don't do that again." And then the belt came off, and chase was on. I'd get whippings when I was a kid, and I wouldn't understand what the whipping was for. And I think, you know, okay, well, I screwed up, but isn't this a little over the top? You know, I'd go to school with welts on me that nowadays would get somebody put in prison and they have the kid taken away from the parents. And I didn't think anything about it, really. I'd spare the rod, spoil the child. That's what church taught us. You're supposed to accept these whippings with grace and dignity. Well, that's hard to do because they hurt. Anyway, what time is it? I don't want to run over. 47. So I got, 30 minutes? Where does real strength come from? Real strength comes from humility. I'm not doing this like an ask it basket. I just wanted to mention that tonight, that I did find out through this program that real strength does come from humility. The people who are the most powerful and the people who can make people do what they tell them to do through force are not powerful at all. What they are is stronger than the other person. But anyone who rules through fear is despised. And me and Chad have talked about that a lot. There's a book I was letting him read that talks about that. When I am an example to other people and I show them what I want them to be, then people begin to want what I have, and they begin to want to follow me as a leader of whatever I'm a leader of. Gandhi said, "Be the change you want to see in the world." And I love that quotation. That's how I have come to be friends with the person I used to despise. There was a person that, and Adam knows who I'm talking about. There was a person that we didn't get along at all. It was so much worse than oil and water. It was like, magnesium and water. When they get together, something happens, usually a fire. But I decided to start looking for the God spirit in this person. I started studying Eastern philosophy, and all the philosophy I was studying told me, said, start looking for the good in people, not the bad. So I started looking for the God spirit in this guy. And eventually, I began to see it more and more and more and more, and eventually, it started actually coming out of him. And now that we're good friends, you know, we don't run around together, but he has really morphed into something that he never thought he would become. I've heard him quote some really spiritual people, and at one time, he did not believe in spirituality at all. I learned something in this program that says, and I tell this to my sponsees, and it drives them nuts. How you do anything is how you do everything. When I'm talking to somebody about working their program, I think how you do the rest of your life is how you're going to do this program. If you want something different, you've got to do something different than what you have been doing. You have got to work the rest of your life now like you work this program. And you've got to be diligent and thorough with this program. If you're going to get what I've gotten out of this program, that's what you're going to have to do. The rest of it's up to you. I can't tell anybody what to do. Can't tell them what to believe. Can't tell them what God to bow down to or anything else. All I can tell them is what has happened for me. What has happened for me is a life that I, as Pat Hilton used to say, it's beyond my wildest expectations. A life that that there's no possible way I could have ever predicted. My life has opened up for me in ways that that I never would have taken on my own. Just one quick example. I had an office over the Douglasville group in the building that they meet in and had it for about 3 years. And One afternoon, the landlord sent me an email. He said, I need that office vacated by June the 1st. We have a tenant for it. And they were giving me an office to do the maintenance on the building. Well, what he meant for me to do was move to another office. Well, I didn't want to do that. So I just moved out. Like any good little alcoholic would. Show you, don't hurt me. Well, anyway, there was a guy standing outside the Douglasville group that owned a business that had a offices for rent. And he said, I went down and asked him, I said, is there any possible way I could get one of your U-Hauls and come up here and get my stuff? He said, where are you going? I said, I don't know. I said, I got to put it in one of your storage units, I guess. He said, well, I got office rent down there. He said, just go down there and get Carlos and that other boy. Bring them up here and move your stuff down there. Now, this happened right outside the office after I'd just gotten evicted. Was this God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself? Gee, I wonder. So many things in my life have happened like that. I had a picture of my pickup truck on my wall for 6 months. And the only difference in it was blue. The one I had on the wall was blue. And I'm over that now. It's okay. I got a phone call one afternoon, and a family member called me, and he said, is there any way you could come down here for a day or two? And I said, well, yeah. I said, do I need to bring any tools? What, you want me to work? He said, no. He said, oh, I got a truck I need to get back to Georgia. And I said, where in Georgia does it need to go? He said, to your driveway. I said, what? He said, I bought you a truck. And I said, well, how much is this going to cost me? He said, it's not going to cost you anything. Come get it. I said, you mean that's my truck sitting in your driveway? He said, absolutely. He said, come get it. So Mike drove me down there the next day, wasn't it? Mike drove me down there the next day. And we picked that truck up. And that's one reason I talk about this story is because Mike can vouch for it. He was there. It was just the most amazing thing I've ever experienced in my life. Nobody's ever done anything like that for me. They wanted me doing stuff like that for them. And then they would disappear after I would do something like that. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is just over and over and over and over and over, and I can't say over enough times. God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. God has put things in my life exactly where they were supposed to be. Every sponsee I have is in my life for a reason. I love every one of them. I learn from them. I get more out of it than they do. And I wish I didn't have to charge them so much. But the one thing that I have learned is I never have to be afraid of anything again. I'm not afraid of tomorrow. I'm not afraid of the hereafter. I'm not afraid of my past anymore because I've learned how to put my past in the proper perspective. I learned that fear comes from a separation from God. As soon as I've separated myself from God, I've got no new power flowing in like the book talks about. I'm on my own. I'm running on my own batteries. They get weak. I can't compete with everybody else on weak batteries, and fear sets in. I live in a constant state of anxiety until I can once again hook up with that source and get recharged. There's a piece of God, I believe, put in me at the point of my conception, my entire journey through this planet. That piece of God that resides in me is constantly seeking to be reunited with its source. That's why I want to pray. That's why I want there to be a God. That's why I want to find some humility. That's why I want to become a conduit of God's grace coming through me going to other people. And living from that standing, my life is amazing. I wouldn't trade it with anybody. But if you got a checkbook with you, I might sell you some of it. Thank you all.